My name is Mark Thomas, and I'm going to tell you how I gained my first million and how you can too. You might have to come back 50 years from now to hear that story. But I teach at Cushing High School. I'm a math and science teacher there. That's what I do for a living. I teach in the state of Oklahoma, which kind of tells you about the money that I make. My wife stays home with our four boys, and so this is not an example necessarily of what to do with a lot of money, but what to do with what God's given us. So hopefully we'll learn a little bit as we go. Let's go ahead and start out in prayer. Heavenly Father, I just lift up to you our time together, and I pray, Lord, for all of the guys that are here, for their families that are represented. I pray, Lord, that you would just open their hearts to hear what you would have them to hear. And as they listen, that they may be able to take things and be able to apply them, that they would be able to use those things wisely. And just the resources that you've entrusted to us, help us to realize that it's yours. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, I'm going to mention to you a couple of friends that I have. One of the reasons why finances is a topic that I enjoy helping others with. If I weren't a high school teacher, what I probably would be is some sort of financial counselor. Because I think it's important. I think it's an area that a lot of people struggle in. I have a friend, and this girl is my good friend, and she's married. And they'd been married a while, and later they found out that the husband had been lying to her and had run up close to $40,000 in credit card debt out of the blue. Now, granted, there was a lot of work that needed to be done as far as building back the relationships that had been torn apart. But on their meager income of around $20,000, $25,000, God used me to help them try to get a plan together to get out of debt. And they were able to do that within about 3.5 years. They cut back on everything and spent nothing extra. And not only has their financial aspect grown considerably, but their relationship with each other is probably the biggest thing. And even before we knew about the problems that were going on, their marriage was weaker, evidently, to us, even whenever there wasn't the known deception that was there. But because they're on the same page financially, that's tremendously helped them out. So this is an area that I think that we can definitely work in. There are three handouts that you have. One of the handouts at the top says financial thinkers. And these are just some thought-provoking questions. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have you all, and you all can pair up if you want, as you want to go over them. Take a look at these questions and go through those. I'll give you about 3 or 4 minutes. Go through, see which answers apply to you, and see which ones make you think a little bit. And then we'll start in on some more things involving stewardship. So go ahead and answer those. Just that one page. You can work together in groups on that. Maybe you'll read them a little closer that way. All right, we're not going to go over those one at a time. I think as we go throughout our workshop, you'll see that we'll hit most of those items. Just trying to get you thinking about where you are financially and perhaps some of the things that you need to be paying attention to as we discuss finances. Let's take a look at another handout that's there. And at the top of it, it says stewardship. And this will be our main handout as we go through. Up at the top, 1 Corinthians 4:2, it says, "Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful." And usually, whenever we think of the word steward or stewardship, you hear it in context of somebody's going to build a building, and we're going to have a stewardship drive, which means come pledge that you're going to give so much for the next 20 years so we can build our building. Let's take a look at what a steward is. Back in the King James's day, they had to make a decision of how to describe what was going on whenever they were talking about finances. And basically what a steward was you had a lord over a certain region, and he had people that would live on the land, and it was his land, grow crops, the crops were his, he provided for them, He would protect them. But in reality, the land was his, the crops was his, were his. So one thing that we've got to realize whenever we look at stewardship is it's not ours. Whenever we talk about the blessings that God has given us, the finances that we have, it's not ours. We are serving the Lord of the manor, and all of the possessions and all of the growth is his. A common day analogy to look at would be an account manager. If you go down and open up a savings account or a mutual fund, the person that's opening up the account is the owner of the account. The account manager just manages the money, but it's not his money. Whenever we're looking at our finances, it's God's money, it's not ours. We are his account managers. He's entrusted a certain amount to us. It may be more than what we want, possibly. It may be less than what we want. But in reality, he's chosen how much to entrust to us, and it's his money. And we need to be aware that all of the money that we have, it's his, and we should be under his direction as to what he wants us to do with it. Let's take a look at Matthew 25, 14 through 28. And as y'all are looking there, I want to warn you of something. You're going to hear a couple different themes throughout this workshop. And what you're going to be thinking is that as we're speaking, we're along one rail. And then later on, you'll hear us and you'll think we're on a totally different rail. If you'll step back and look at it, they're actually both rails of the same train track heading in the same direction. And you need both of them in order to accomplish what we're after here. In Matthew 25, 14 through 28, it says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a man traveling to a far country, who called his own servants and delivered his goods to them. And to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability. And immediately he went on a journey. Then he who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them and made another 5 talents. And likewise he who had received 2 gained 2 more also. But he who had received 1 went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. So he who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, 'Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Look, I have gained 5 more talents besides them.'" Let's stop right there. I think sometimes whenever we look at finances, either we take a hands-off approach and we just completely ignore it, or we view it as, I'm just going to sit back and do nothing. It's either out of ignorance that we do nothing, or we choose to do nothing. The first person that reports back to the Lord didn't just bring back the 5 talents. He brought back the 5 plus another 5. Let's keep that in mind. "His Lord said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord.' He also who had received 2 talents came and said, 'Lord, you delivered to me 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more talents besides them.' His Lord said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord.' Then he who had received the 1 talent came and said, 'Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours.' But his Lord answered and said to him, 'You wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have at least received back money with my own interest. Therefore, take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. I think the idea that we see here as far as stewardship, and that's truly what these guys were, it wasn't their money at all, is the idea of growth, and we need to be proactive in that. We need to not just sit back and let money just happen, but we need to be proactive in our planning of how we handle the finances that we have. Can someone look up 1 Timothy 5:8, Proverbs 27:23, and 2 Thessalonians 3:10? And if you've got it, then just stand up and read it out loud so everyone can hear.
If anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever.
So what are we charged to do here?
Work.
Yeah. We've got to provide. We've got to look out for our own. Okay, we're going to provide for our own household. Proverbs 27:23.
Be sure to know the condition of your flocks. Give careful attention to your herds.
The first question that we had on that financial thinkers was, I reflect on my financial health, and then it had some options there. Are we guilty of not knowing the state of our own flocks out of ignorance or fear of what we'll find out? This charge is to know the state of our flocks. We need to know where we are financially. And 2 Thessalonians 3:10.
For even when we are with you, we give you this rule. If a man will not work, he shall not eat.
To sit around and do nothing, as I see out of these verses, is not necessarily an option. Okay? We need to be proactive in our growth. We need to provide for our own household. We need to know the state of our flocks. And we need to work. Proverbs 22:6. Who has that one memorized?
Train up a child the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it.
As a parent, that one is comforting and challenging at times. Anybody have Proverbs 22:7 memorized?
Dave Ramsey. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender.
Dave Ramsey does mention this quite a bit. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is slave to the lender. I find it interesting that verse 7 comes after verse 6. We are to train up our children. One of the aspects that we need to train our children in is the area of finances. And I think that a lot of times as I encounter high school students or college students that we might be working with, there's a lot of ignorance out there, and they haven't been trained how to deal with finances. So I think that combination there, that we are to train, and one of those things that we're supposed to train about is how to deal with our finances. Proverbs 29:17 says, correct your son, and he will give you rest. Yes, he will give delight to your soul. And usually whenever I hear this verse, I think about a misbehavior that's just obvious that we need to correct our children on. One of the things, again, just to prove it again here, that we need to correct our children on is the area of finances. A lot of times we will have siblings or kids that are not dealing with their finances very well. And it's hard to, at the age, if you have a kid that's at the age of 22 or 23 out of college, and they're messing up with their finances, at that point, it's a little difficult to come to them and try to instruct them. So what we need to do is we need to make sure as they're young, from the very early times, that we start building into them some financial principles of how to deal with money. Because if we don't deal with it, the world's going to teach them how. And that's for sure. That's a definite. Okay, that's a little bit of an overview of stewardship. Any questions so far on that? Okay, and there's a lot of things we could say on stewardship, but we've got some other things we want to get to here. Okay. Rusty Goss is going to come talk to us about giving. Rusty I've known for 12 years or so, and watched him, know him in great detail, know his family in great detail, and I tell you what, if there's something that I need and it's in Rusty's garage, he says, go get it. And it's just automatic. This guy does know how to give, even if he may not admit it. He does know how to give. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say.
This has been quite an opportunity for me to get the privilege to spend some time, particularly looking at giving. I think that God and Mark have a sense of humor and putting me in a position. Hey, Russ wants to talk about giving. Sure, no big deal. And the more I studied and the more I dug and the more I read, the bigger it got and the more convicting it got. It's a challenging, challenging subject, particularly to us American men. You guys will get together in accountability groups. You'll talk about sex. You'll talk about the law. You'll talk about your jobs. You'll talk about money, but you don't talk about giving because it's sensitive. It hits you right in your pocketbook, and it's convicting. To deny yourself, to give yourself up in service, that's tough, and a lot of us do that. But to deny ourselves the pleasures of the finances that we work real hard to provide for ourselves, well, there are some sacrifices, and that's hard. So I may say some things. My intent is to challenge you and to draw you closer to where God may have you to be. I don't have all the answers, and I'm still growing. And if you don't get anything out of this, it's been worthwhile, because, well, I sure have. So I hope that you can glean just a portion of what I've spent the last couple months looking at. Just to give us some perspective, I want you to think about the righteous rich man who came to Christ. What was his dilemma? What was his question for Christ? There in Matthew 19:16. Right. What was he? He was righteous. He had obeyed the law. What did Christ tell him to do? He was rich and wealthy, and he said, sell all you have, give it to the poor. And what did he do? Turned around and walked away. From my point of view, I read that and I go, gosh, what an idiot. He missed it. He was right there with Christ and he missed the whole thing. It's easy from my point of view to be very critical of him. Put yourself in his shoes. And let me say, you are in his shoes. The Bible talks more about finances than almost any other subject. Why is that? Because I need it. He talks about giving almost as much as anything else. Why do we ignore that? Do we? Maybe we're all great givers in here. I'll challenge you here. There's a verse, kind of my life verse, we're going to repeat several times here. Does anyone know Romans 12, 1 and 2? If you know it, just spout it out. Scott, no, you know it.
I urge you to live by the mercies of God. Present your body as a living, holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is spiritual service of worship. And not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by renewing your mind, and the goodness of the Lord God, that was good, acceptable, and
I'll ask you, do you give and handle your finances as a sacrifice and a way of worshiping the Lord, or has the culture skewed your idea of your giving? Think about that. We'll keep on that verse, so we'll repeat that several times. Let me look at verse first, just to give us some clarity on part of our calling here. I'm just going to read 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 9. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. Godliness. I want to be godly. Well, contentment is valued, as far as the Lord's concerned, if we brought nothing into the world and take nothing out. There's our perspective. The stewardship aspect is not mine. I came in with nothing, and I'm leaving with nothing. All this other stuff that I have here, well, it's not mine, it's the Lord's. You need to keep that perspective. We have probably some younger guys in here. I have a line there. I'd like you, this is just for yourself, to write down how much money you made last year. Just close. I don't need any tax return stuff. Even you college or high school kids, did anyone make less than $1,500 last year? $1,500. You can mow several lawns and reach that in a year. Did anyone make less than $1,500 in this room? Well, everyone in this room made more money than 80% of the rest of the world. That's pretty powerful. If you had sufficient food, decent clothes, if you live in a house or an apartment, and if you have decent transportation, that includes donkeys and camels, you're in the top 15% of the world's wealth. You guys feel rich? When you think of rich people, do you think of yourself as the rich people? I honestly don't when I think of rich people. If you have any money saved, if you have a hobby requiring any equipment, from racquetball to skis, if you have a variety of clothes in your closet, I do. If I have two cars, any condition, and if you are a homeowner, doesn't mean you own your home, but if you have a homeowner, if you're paying on a mortgage, you are in the top 5% of wealth for the world. When Christ talks to the rich, who's he talking to? He's talking to us. Sheds a new light on when you read about the rich. Someone please look up 2 Corinthians 9, 10 and 11. As you're reading, I'm going to stop you at a point. I'm not being rude. But if someone will read that loud.
As it is written, he has distributed freely, he has given to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will buy and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness.
Go ahead and go on. Do that next verse.
You will be enriched in every way for all your...
Okay. You will be made rich in every way so that what? In your own words, why are you being made rich? All of us in here have determined we are somewhere, probably in the top 5 to 15% of the world's wealth. Why has God blessed you with that wealth? How you answer that question greatly impacts your aspect of giving. If you read on that verse, it says, so that you can be generous on every occasion, and though through us your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. Why is he telling you you're rich? So that I can live in luxury, have the pool, the Sea-Doos, the Lexus, the snowmobile, and boy, howdy, convicting to me the four-wheeler. The guns, the vacations, is that why you're blessed? Is that why you're rich? Are those things evil? Those things aren't evil. But why have we been blessed? If you're thinking eternally, if you want to go through your financial life with an eternal perspective, if you want to make an impact, and you want to use every resource God's given you, your voice, your eyes, your hands, your legs, your finances, why has he given it to you? We say it's from the Lord. So you can be generous. Give it away. We're going to continue to challenge you in that regard. Give it away. I suppose that if I lined up all of you and everyone in the conference and asked you probably the hardest question that I hope not to dive into very far, do you tithe or do you give freely? You would have quite a discussion. It would probably get fairly heated before it was over with. And that is deserving on your part, each and every one of you, to spend a great deal of time to look at tithing and grace giving. It has been very enlightening to me over the last couple of months to look at those issues. With our wealth in mind, let me just throw this out at you. And this is not an answer for either one. I do have an opinion. And by the way, a tithe was 20%, 10 to the Levites, 10 to the poor, first year. Second year, if you're going by Mosaic law, tithe system. Second year, 10% to the poor, 10% to the Levites, the church. And every third year, it was 30%. And that extra 10 went to the widows. So on average, you paid 23%. Not 10, 23. That was the law. Grace giving, which we are under, and so were they in the Old Testament, grace giving. On average, 4 of 10 churchgoers give nothing. And the rest give 2.5% of their income. Those are American Christians. A very uncomfortable question you have to ask yourself. if the nation of Israel gave 23% on average, or even if you said the 10%, wouldn't that make the law four times more effective than grace? That's convicting. Is there something wrong with that? Is there something wrong with our Christian giving in America if the law was more effective than grace? That's uncomfortable to hear. That's uncomfortable to say. I challenge you to look at your giving. Look at what God has done in your life through your finances and evaluate if you're wealthy and if you're willing to invest your finances as a steward of the Lord and give to Him and give to His work. Well, we are commanded to give generously. Rick, you got Romans 12, 1 and 2 again?
Therefore, I urge you, brothers, as you have got mercy, to offer yourselves as living sacrifices, only as pleasing to God. This is the spirit of the Lord. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, so that you may be able to approve and test what God's will is, His good, perfect, and pleasing will.
We want to conform to the image of Christ, not to the patterns of this world. I ask you again, does our culture, does our American culture, help to justify the way you handle your finances? Or are you willing to offer your bodies and your feet and your minds and your finances and your hands and your voice to be a sacrifice holy and pleasing to God? I do. I hope you guys do too. Spend the rest of my life trying to get my arms around that. So we're to give. We're to give generously. We are to give sacrificially. 2 Corinthians 8, 2 and 3. This is the Macedonian church. Paul is writing to them. Let me ask you, let me read this. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability. What in the world does severe trial, overflowing joy, extreme poverty, and rich generosity have to do in one verse? How can that all be in one verse? What an example for us. I don't know extreme poverty. I am not wealthy. I've got 4.5 kids. One's due in July. I'm an Aggie. I work for an old co-op. We're not just raking it in. We live within our means. We're very comfortable. And yet we're still in the top 5% of wealth for the world. Keep in mind. But I don't know extreme poverty. And yet, out of the overflowing joy, in their extreme poverty, during a severe trial, in their rich generosity, they gave. They gave of themselves first, and then they gave richly, beyond their ability. There's three ways you can give. You can give under your ability, you can give according to your ability, or you can give beyond your ability. Our example here is to give beyond your ability and enjoy the rich generosity that you have in giving to the Lord. Good friend of mine, as I was talking through him on some of these things, he took me to Esther. I did not go to Esther in all of my research over giving. I should have, because there's a huge principle here. All of you know Esther, either from a series of Bible studies, all your time in Sunday school, and if you've watched VeggieTales. That's not a bad description of the story of Esther. It's my favorite VeggieTales. If I could do Mr. Lunt's voice, I would for you, but I can't. Mordecai, Esther's uncle, he's having the struggle there, and because of his hatred with Haman, Haman has successfully gone through all the needed paperwork to go ahead and dispose of the Jews, the nation of Israel, and eliminate them from the earth. And let me read this. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone, he's talking to Esther, of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for what? Such a time as this. Even my kids know that. For such a time as this. One of the most popular things my kids say, with Mr. Lund's voice, appropriately. Back up a verse. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish, and who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. Does God need Esther to save the nation of Israel? If she doesn't do it, he's going to find it somewhere else. He already has his plan. We have the whole book. We got the end story. He wins. We know it. He doesn't need your money. Our gold is gravel to him. He doesn't need it. If he wants to bless a nation, if he wants to do something for someone, he'll get it done. But he's giving us the opportunity to partake. He's saying, are you with me or are you not? I'm inviting you to enjoy and trust me. You skim it all down, he's asking you to trust him. And the hardest thing for a man, I think, is to give up his pocketbook. That doesn't mean you got to live on a street corner. It just means you got to trust him and give. Not store it up, but give. Whenever I get confused with all this stuff, I've been very comforted by my example of guys you know well, John Crawford and Gene Ware. What's John Crawford have wealth-wise in terms of material things? John Crawford doesn't have much. He pretty much lives pretty much depending on the Lord through and through. Has everything he needs. And just by being around him, he wouldn't have any idea unless you knew him personally. Gene Ware, what's his material world like? Probably wealthier than anybody I know. I don't know either one of them enough where I could walk in their door. But I know of them enough to know that they have totally different material worlds. You could take everything from Gene Ware and put it on Crawford and put Crawford's lifestyle on Gene Ware. I don't think it'd faze him a bit. It does not matter how much you make. It is your perspective and your trust in the Lord that he cares about. It's your heart. Both of them give. What's our example of the old lady at the temple? What did she give? All that she had. How much was that? 100%. Probably enough to buy a gumball. But she gave more than any. He doesn't need our money. He needs your heart. He needs your trust. He doesn't need your cash. He'll use it. But he doesn't need it. He is merely giving you an avenue to lean on him. He has taught me more through my finances if I've tried to screw up in my life than anything else I've gone through. And I am trying to tackle that job of trusting him. And I have successfully jumped way off of the outline. He wants me to give the best. Why does he want you to give the best? What can you learn through giving the best? What's that? Is there sacrifice in giving the best? What do we naturally want to do? Keep the best. Say you got a couch. You got two couches, Cliff, in your house. Nice couches. For some reason, you want a different couch. Find a really slick leather one with the remote control and the handle. Lazy boy vibrator deal. You buy it. Well, you don't have room for three couches. You got room for two couches. The third couch, what are you going to do with it? You're going to sell it or you're going to give it away? What are you going to do? Put you on the spot. But is it wrong in selling it? That's not necessarily wrong in selling it, no. Is it a good thing to give it away? Yeah. Will someone be blessed by that couch? Are you sacrificially giving? Cost you nothing. You don't have room for it. I don't know that that's giving. It's more like selective disposal. I think you can bless someone with that couch. That's giving. But it's not sacrificial giving. Sacrificial giving is having my finances in order. I've got my budget. I'm giving such and such, and this is my giving. My wife and I are plugging along month to lunk. We're involved in different ministries, and the tsunami hits. Oh, gosh. I feel kind of convicted to give to the tsunami fund. Those people are hurting over there. It's just not my budget, though. Oh, they got nothing. They don't even have houses. Little kids wandering around. Think you'd give up $200? Cost you a couple meals at McAllister's Deli and maybe not as much milk that week. That's sacrificial giving. Are you sacrificially giving? What's the benefit to you? God will bless you richly. What's He love? He loves a joyful giver. If He only would have given us some sort of a sacrificial example. What's the ultimate example we have? He gave us all. He gave us His Son. Did we deserve any of it? Did it cost Him everything? It cost Him everything. $200 doesn't seem like much. Finally, as I get choked up, give cheerfully. Have fun. Enjoy it. Enjoy giving and watching your blessings multiply. 2 Corinthians 9:7. Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. He doesn't put up with givers. He loves a cheerful giver. Does anyone in here not want to be loved by God? Man, He loves that about a giver. Give. He's so proud of you. I've yet to find anywhere in here He says, man, you've been doing a great job. Get yourself a Sea-Doo, kick back, get a Coke, and watch some ESPN. Now, those people take care of themselves over there. Now He's saying, I've blessed you richly. Give to them. You don't need it. You got more than you can mess with. And by the way, it's all going to burn up anyway. What are you holding on to? I might die tomorrow. All those things I'm holding on to, certain clothes, vehicles, all of a sudden they're of absolutely no use to me in eternity. 10,000 years from now, that pickup is still meaningless. Could that blessing have gone to further His kingdom? Big time. So invest with an eternal perspective. Do it with a good attitude. And do it for God. Don't do it for show. Don't do it for the sight of man. Do it for God. Honor Him. There are times to show your good deeds so that others can be blessed by your service and your deeds. So there's a balance there. God knows the motive of your heart. Give to Him. The final illustration I think Mark and I wanted to make sure we got in. Actually, I heard it from Jerry Strader after he had lost his wife. One of the best workshops I've been to. He told the story of Gene War and his perspective on money. And people had asked him, how do you do it? And Gene War has an open hand theory. God puts it in, and it just goes through. If my hand's clenched, and I've got all the things that I have, if God wants it, is He going to take it? He's going to take it. And it hurts a whole lot more when He has to pry your fingers open to get it. But He's going to get it. But if my hand's open, He can take it freely. He can also put it in freely. Let's be funnels. A greased up big old funnel where God can just plow down riches upon you so that He can funnel them to people who need it through you. And who gets the blessing? The giver. Who's blessed in your giving? the giver, the recipient, and God. Pretty good motivation. Now, this is a lot of theory, and it's harder to put in practice. How many times have I read through Timothy, 1 and 2 Corinthians, and just haphazardly skipped over those convicting passages? After Mark has tortured me through this preparation, I can't skip over those anymore. I pray, and we have prayed many times, that you will leave this workshop convicted, not offended. Intent was not to offend, it was to encourage and remind you that stewardship is a reminder of an eternal perspective and how to give to the Lord. Are there any questions with giving? I'd be scared to ask too. If not, we'll have another question time at the end, and I'll give it back to Mark.
One of the things that I think that I'm learning just from listening to Rusty and working with Rusty is I've had a burden for quite a while to help people with their finances, and one of the biggest areas is dealing with debt. And I think that one of the reasons that I felt like I needed to help them with debt was to get things squared away, so that way they can provide for themselves in later age. But I think that what Rusty's really opened my eyes up to, just in working with him over the last couple of months, is one of the biggest reasons that we need to work on our debt issue is that it hinders our giving. If we're slaves to someone else, it's kind of hard to give whenever you've got a creditor calling all the time. It's kind of hard to give whenever, if you don't make that payment, they come and take it back. Maybe that's the best thing for us, actually. But I think that one of the things that we're going to look at as we look over our debt issue is it's helpful if we can get to the place to where we have no masters over us financially. And that way we're listening to one master. And if God says give, you give. And we don't have to worry about anybody else calling us. So let's take a look at that next page there, dealing with debt. You just flip on the same page there. One of the interesting stats that I saw as I was doing some research on this, I knew that the issue of finances was brought up quite a bit in the Bible. And one of the stats said that if you compare the area of finances to all of the topics on the discussion on faith and prayer combined, and you compare those two, finances gets talked about twice as much as the area of faith and prayer combined. I think it's because God knew that we are selfish and we want to hang on to things. We don't view things as His, and we get ourselves in trouble as we pile more and more debt on ourselves. So if we can learn to work within the framework of spending what we have, using it for God's work, then we'd be a lot better off. Let's go ahead and take a look at a few stats here. These are a couple of stats on baby boomers. I'm sure that the rest of the population is not too far off from the baby boomer stats here. Car payments. 56% of Americans have car payments. It's normal. In fact, it's kind of comical. Every now and then you'll see a car that says, "Don't laugh, it's paid for." But that's the abnormal route. Most people have a car payment, and the people that have car payments just carry on as if, "I'm always going to have a car payment. Of course I have a car payment. How else can you do it?" As far as 90-day same as cash, that's kind of a common phrase. 78% of the people that use 90-day same as cash don't pay it off within 90 days. No big deal. You just pay some interest. Well, usually that interest kicks in at 24%. And at 24%, they don't start it from the 91st day. They backtrack you all the way to the first day. So what they've done is they've got you in the door thinking that you have free money to spend, and when you can't come up with the money, they backlog you for the percent. So a couple things we've got to be careful about. 1910, in the Sears catalog, it said buying on credit is folly or foolish. Well, yeah, I'd agree with that. That same company now earns more income from interest on credit than they do actually selling their merchandise. A little bit of a turnaround there. They are a credit company. That's what they do. They sell things along the way, but they are a credit company. One of the things we've got to realize is that we are marketed to. And if we don't realize that, then we just get sucked in along with all the commercials that tell us that it's okay, with all of our friends that have the 10 credit cards in their wallet that are maxed out, and we just feel that we are completely normal. If we look at what McDonald's said, you deserve a break today. Nike said, just do it. I think if you order a Whopper, you can have it your way. We are marketed to in such a sense that we begin to feel that we deserve that break today, regardless if we have that finances available to take that vacation to the Bahamas. I deserve a break today because I heard somebody once upon a time tell me I deserved a break today. Happened to be a commercial, but still, I deserve a break today. One of the ones that get me the most is the Capital One commercial. The people at the football game, there's a family, husband and wife, and I believe two or three kids there with them. And they're at the football game, so excited and everything, and they go to the concession area, and they order the hot dogs and drinks and stuff, and the bill comes to something like $120. And you see the big beast and the big people coming out with all the armor and the swords and the spears coming after them. And then they go, oh, don't worry, I've got my Capital One credit card. Now, the interesting thing on that is that everybody focuses on the fact that, oh, they're wise people. They're paying less interest rate on that. The foolish thing is that they're putting on a credit card that they're obviously not intending to pay off because they're worried about the interest rate. They're comparing interest rates here. A hot dog, which will go through them within the next 24 hours. And that $110 payment will be with them for the next 2 years. So I think that one of the things that we've got to be careful about is we really need to realize that we're marketed to. So strongly that they can put absurd things in front of you and you don't realize where the absurdity is. The absurdity is not those gladiators coming after the people. That's not absurd. The absurd thing is that they're buying their hot dogs with credit card and they'll probably spend more toilet paper over the next 2 years than what they would on the hot dog. 60% have continuing credit card debt, and I've seen different percentages. That's probably actually one of the conservative percentages that I've seen. 6 out of 10 people. The average consumer debt per person is about $7,100. That's not per family. That's per person. I have 6 in my family, which means that I would be owing around $42,000. That's a lot of money. A couple things as far as do's and don'ts involving credit cards and debt. And later on, I'll show you where I have some resources. And I list on there Dave Ramsey and I list on there Crown Financial Ministries. And I've looked at both of them. And they don't agree about everything. So some of this stuff you may not agree on me with. And that's fine. You'll need to figure it out where it fits in your overall game plan. First one is don't use debt consolidation. One of the problems that we have with if you're going to use a debt consolidation company is a lot of times what they'll do is they'll lower your monthly payment, but that drags on for a longer period of time. Now you are a slave instead of for 3 years, you're a slave now for 15 years. Another thing is that if you don't change your habit of getting into debt, you're going to get right back into debt. You'll have your consolidated loans and a whole bunch of new debt. And the third reason that I've seen, as far as not using a debt consolidation, is a lot of companies, whenever they see that on your credit report, will view that as if you've gone bankrupt. I don't necessarily think it says bankrupt there, but they view it as an equivalent to you went bankrupt. You were not able to handle your finances. You were essentially bankrupt. Okay. Speaking of bankruptcy, I saw a stat that said most Americans are 3 to 6 weeks away from bankruptcy. If you lost your income for 3 weeks, most Americans would be bankrupt. Second item there, don't roll your debt into home equity loans. Now, it's interesting because at the different websites that I've seen it listed differently. Why should we not roll our debt into home equity loans? Anybody got any good reasons? Yeah. Now, instead of being able to pay off that credit card with that $120 hot dog, which they can't take back from you, now you've put up your house as collateral, and they'll take your home away. That, to me, is one of the biggest reasons why. And as I counseled my friends that I told you about at the beginning of the workshop, that was one of the things that they were seriously looking at doing, was rolling all of their debt into a home equity loan. And I strongly urged them not to. They were able to break the habit and get out of debt with their home intact, without putting their home up for collateral. Don't buy brand new cars. I have friends that buy brand new cars. Don't buy brand new cars. Why? If you drive it off the lot and then turn right back around and take it and sell it back to them, you can't even get what you owe on it. The depreciation is incredible how quickly it drops. If you like the smell of new leather, go find one of those little air fresheners and put it in your vehicle and make your vehicle smell like new leather. As far as buying new cars, you will save quite a bit of money buying a 2 or 3 year old vehicle. Or for some of us, we've bought 10 or 12 year old vehicles. You know, if it doesn't have 120,000 miles when you buy it, well, it's too new for some of us. Rusty had a van that recently went over 300,000 miles. And it was running pretty good there.
Gave it away,
it's still on the road, so look out. I have some family members that save a lot of money. And the way that they save a lot of money is they buy great deals. I don't know if you've ever ran into anybody like that. It's a $30 item, but it's on sale for 10 bucks, so I just saved 20 bucks. Do you need the item? No. Were you planning on buying it? No. But it's a good deal. I just saved 20 bucks. You're out 10. Okay? We need to work on some math here. That's a minus 10, not a plus 20. Okay? Just because it's a good deal doesn't mean you can afford it. And just because you can afford it doesn't mean God desires for you to have it. One of the habits that I've been able to develop over the years, and it's kind of a stubborn habit, is if anybody calls me up, solicits money, or if I'm out trying to buy something, a vehicle, a house, anything like that, and there's pressure there at all, I turn around and I walk away. I'm gone. If you can't sell me that thing at that price tomorrow, and it has to be done in the next 36 seconds, I'm out the door. Okay? I'll come back and deal with you tomorrow and see if you really want to sell it. But be careful of being pressured into that. A couple of do things. First thing we need to do is we've got to break that cycle. I have a verse here for you. 2 Corinthians 12:9-10. And he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. Well, I'm thrilled now. Sounds like fun. Sign me up. The last sentence here, though, sums it all up. For when I am weak, then I am strong. That is such contradictory statements that without God, it's impossible to even understand how that could be possible. Okay? When I am weak, then I am strong. One of the things that we've got to do is be able to rely on God's strength. We need to pray. We need to become accountable. Ecclesiastes 4, 9 and 10. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. One of the best things that has probably happened in my spiritual life was 11, 12 years ago, a group of guys in Stillwater started an accountability group. And we've been going for about 12 years now, hammering each other over the head with accountability questions and trying to hold each other's toes to the fire. One of the best, most growing times that we've had is whenever we have realized that we are there to hold the other people accountable. And we've gone through several transformations as a group. But I can remember in particular, we were very lazy at trying to hold each other accountable. And a lot of it dealt with, we were failing in a certain area. And so we weren't dare about to ask someone else about that same area. Well, accountability is, if you give me license to hold you accountable, it's my job, it's my duty to grill you over those issues. In love, but not to grill you over those issues. And I think that Proverbs 27, 5 and 6 says it really well. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy, they're deceitful. If we have a friend, a faithful friend, and he's willing to wound us for our sake, that's a whole lot better than just going around with a smile on our face and having kisses from an enemy, because that's deceitful. So one of the things we need to do is we need to become accountable to someone in order to work our way out of debt. And you need to find someone that will hold you accountable, not someone who will just kind of act like they're holding you accountable. When you mess up, they need to be able to tell you, hey, you messed up. And they're telling you that out of love. Third one that I have there is pay cash for cars. We might have a little time to look at something. I'll point it out later about how if you will delay your pleasure for a while and buy an older vehicle, you will not fall into the cycle of needing to buy a car on credit. Okay? But it takes some sacrifice up at that front end. Okay? And I'll point that out to you whenever we have a chance there. I just listed this website, www.bankrate.com. It's a website that I found that lists credit rates. Don't go there to find a new credit card for yourself because you don't have one. But if you have this 26% credit card and you're going, wow, this is just eating me alive. If I could just get it down a ways, this is a place that they list the different credit rates for the different credit card companies. Okay, don't go there to try to take out a new loan, but I just want to make that available to you. Proverbs 6, 1 through 5. Let's take a look at that. If someone could turn there, Proverbs 6, 1 through 5, and read that for us.
My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast secured thy hand with a stranger, thou art a stranger with the roof of thy mouth, thou art taken with the roof of thy mouth. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself, and thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Go humble thyself and ensure thy friend. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler.
The level of intensity here is quite high. Do not sleep. Go immediately and deliver yourself from the hand of the fowler. Dave Ramsey uses an illustration about doing things with gazelle-like intensity. And it's great to watch the Discovery Channel. and you see that cheetah or the lion approaching a gazelle, and that cheetah or the lion is hunting for that gazelle, working for it. Okay? And that gazelle, all of a sudden, looks around and recognizes that not all is right. I'm about to get eaten. And so what he does is he lays down and waits for the lion to come eat him. I don't think that's exactly how it works. Okay? That gazelle is out of there lightning fast. Gazelle-like intensity. Deliver yourself from the hand of the hunter. Okay? The couple that I had mentioned that paid off $40,000 in debt, they did it with gazelle-like intensity. It was so clear that they were focused. Cut the excess. Now, it's kind of interesting. I think that this is helpful on two fronts. One is to get out of debt, cut the excess. Two is, if you're not in debt, imagine what God could do with that excess if you didn't have it wrapped up in some other things that you may not need. Do you really need? You can fill in the blank there. What is it that you're spending lots of money on? You don't really need it. Would God rather have you use that money to give to someone? If you're in debt and you're spending frivolously on things that you don't need, how wise is that as far as being a steward of the money that He's given to you? Okay. I'll mention three, and the three I'm going to mention are about $30 each. You have cable? $30, $35 a month? Oh, you got to have cable. No, you don't have to have cable. Do you really need it? Do you need a cell phone? Now, some of you guys do. But are you paying on a cell phone, but yet you're struggling on your credit card payment? Do you really need that cell phone? Do you really need that high-speed internet? Oh, but it makes it faster. It's a time-saving tool. You're paying $30 a month on it. If you took all three of those payments, that $90 a month, it's amazing how much debt you could eliminate using that $90 a month. And it's amazing how much of a benefit would be if you're not in debt to be able to give that away. Okay? I'm not telling you to give up cable. I'm saying that there are some things in your life that you could probably look at and say, that's excess. I don't really need it. Okay. On work, Proverbs 20:13. Do not love sleep lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes and you will be satisfied with bread. Maybe we're in debt because we're being lazy, and we're just not working enough. Now, you have to balance that verse out with the other verse that says, do not overwork to be rich. Okay, there's a balance there. You can ask yourself or ask your accountability person, am I working enough hours to help me get out of debt? Am I doing what I need to do to be able to get out of debt? And work is one of those things that is helpful at times to get out of debt. Let's take a look at a debt snowball, and some of you all have seen this because I've heard y'all commenting on it. Yes?
I just have a couple comments.
Yes, please.
And you kind of touched on this, but on B, being accountable, also I'd say seeking wise counsel.
Yes.
Kind of like what you feel like you've been led to do. Mm-hmm. You know, don't talk to a loan officer or a bank, equity loan, to roll your debt into.
Yes.
Go talk to a bankruptcy attorney about whether or not you feel like you can file bankruptcy.
Right. Totally true.
On getting serious, just setting goals. For those of us who are visual, my wife and I, in trying to pay off our home, printed up our amortization chart and actually made extra principal payments and could see that. So I think getting serious, I mean, there's some real practical things you could do to help get out of that. Mm-hmm.
Very true. Take a look at, it's the other handout that you had earlier with the financial thinkers. Thank you for that, by the way. I thought I was the only one that printed out amortization schedules and looked at them. But on the financial thinkers, if you'll open up that page, that left inside, it shows a debt snowball. And I'm amazed at how simple this is. But sometimes people that are in debt just need a little bit of help of telling them what to do. They're willing to do it, but they're just not quite sure what to do. And a lot of times whenever I've been helping people, It's not necessarily that they don't have the resources. They just don't have the focus. Well, what do I pay off first? Well, starting anywhere would be better than starting nowhere. So one of the things that we have here is this idea of a debt snowball. It says, list your non-house debt from smallest to largest, smallest dollar amount to largest dollar amount. Make minimum payments on everything. And so I have three different stages here as this person is trying to get out of debt. The minimum payments on the pennies is 100, the minimum payments on the car is 200, and the minimum monthly payment on the Visa is 300. And it has the beginning balances there. Make extra payments on the smallest balance. So they came up with $400 extra that they could pay. So now they're paying $500 on the pennies card, and it takes them 6 months to pay off that card. They're down from three debts, now down to two debts. Okay? They've paid minimum payments on the others, so those balances have come down some. 6 months later, they start stage two. They only have two debts. They've got the car and they've got the Visa. They're no longer paying to pennies. They were paying $500 to pennies, so they've got an extra $500 now. They were paying $200 on the car, so they throw the extra $500 with the $200 that they were paying on the car. So now they're paying $700 on the car. Still paying $300 on the Visa. It'll take them 13 months to pay off the rest of that $9,100 car loan. That's an additional 13 months after the six. They've completely paid off the car. They now have an extra $700 that they were paying on the car that's freed up. They have $9,000 left on the Visa as they enter stage three. And they lump the $700 that they were paying on the others that's freed up now with the $300 on the Visa. So they're paying $1,000 a month on that Visa, and they knock that thing out within 9 months. It takes them 28 months total for them to get out of that debt. Now, I've completely eliminated any idea of interest here, just to let the numbers be a little easier for us. And also because if you will pay off that smallest one first, it took 6 months to get rid of that pennies card. Imagine the freedom of, instead of every month having to write out three bills, now you're down to two in 6 months' time, half a year. And then 13 months later, you got rid of that car payment, and now you're down to one. You only owe one company money. Now you've got two masters. You've got Visa and you've got God. And then we get rid of Visa. Okay? That's the debt snowball. Yeah.
When we went through this several years ago, there was a desire to look at interest rates and try to match all that up. But again, what we were having to change was behavior. And that was a bigger deal than trying to penny out interest rates. And so to take a small taste of success on that small loan was way more important to us to feel that success of paying off the debt and the snowball than it was stretching it out, because you had a lower interest rate over here, or that school loan that lasts forever, and that kind of stuff. So it's more of a behavior issue initially, I think.
It is definitely emotional to be able to pay off those debts. It is definitely emotional, and probably even more so for our wives, as they see that we're not being in bondage to others. Okay, let's flip back over to our main outline. Americans pay 10 times more on interest than giving to charity. What would the world be like if we paid 10 times more on charity than we did on interest? That'd be something. Savings rate, the average Japanese family saves 18%. Japanese save 18%. The average American family saves negative 2.2%. We spend 2.2% more every month than what we make. Savings ideas. We are commanded in Scripture to leave an inheritance to our children's children. Realize that we are working with a crock pot, not a microwave. We're not looking at get-rich-quick schemes here. We're looking at slow growth over time. If you invested 40 years at $100 a month over 40 years at a 12% rate, it would be $1.2 million. Okay. I have another stat that says if you invest... Oh, we'll get at that other stat later if we've got time. You've got it in a handout there. Emergency funds. My wife enjoys the fact that we have an emergency fund at our house. It is incredibly calming to her. She has a security gland on her that whenever things aren't just quite right, it just messes things up. We had a water heater break not too long ago. And when a water heater breaks, the crisis should be fixing the water heater. So much of the time the crisis, though, is the water heater's busted. We need to fix it. And oh, by the way, we've got to come up with the money, too. Now we've got two crises we're having to deal with. Where's the money coming from? And we got to get the water heater fixed. Okay. Having an emergency fund in place is so helpful in dealing with those life unexpectedness.
Mark?
Yes?
Do I need an emergency fund in place before I start the debt snowball?
Yeah, usually they say save about $1,000 as an emergency fund first, then start on your debt snowball. Because otherwise, you're going to be sidetracked on your debt snowball just endlessly. So you'll have money saved up, $1,000 is what most people say, to take care of that water heater when it breaks. So that way I'm not getting out of debt and then getting higher into debt and getting out of debt and getting higher into debt. So you can pay that out of an emergency fund instead. 3 to 6 months living expenses, $4,000 maybe, $10,000 for others. It needs to be in an easily accessible account. Wives want us to lead, not flounder. My wife wants me to lead in finances. My wife wants me to lead in spiritual aspects. My wife wants me to lead in raising our kids. They're looking for leaders out there. Calvin Coolidge said, there's no dignity quite so impressive and no independence quite so important as living within your means. Any other questions on savings and debt there before we take a quick look at a budget idea?
Enough to people see how they got there?
Yes. And that's, I think, is a part of breaking that cycle. They've got to recognize what they're doing that causes that. Otherwise, they're going to be right back into it. And when we look at our budget here in just a minute, we're going to look at budget busters. And that's, you know, those are the things that typically creep up on us. On our idea there of budget, if you were in command of 100 infantrymen, would you lead by letting them go wherever they wanted? Not a very good plan. Or worse, would you assign 50 to the central point, 50 to the left flank, and 50 to the right flank? Now, I'm a math teacher. Okay? I didn't make a typo, but so much of the time when we're dealing with our own money, that's how we do it. I'll spend 50% of my money here, I'll spend 50% of my money here, and I'll spend 50% of my money here. That's why we have a negative 2.2 savings rate in America. We overspend. We overcommit. Luke 14, 28 through 30, a familiar passage. If we're going to build a tower, we need to consider the cost. We need to have a plan. Whenever we look at working out a budget, on that same page that we were looking at earlier, on the right-hand side of the debt snowball, I filled in one number on this budget. One number on that whole budget have I filled in. Bottom right-hand corner, there's one number there. What is that?
Zero.
Well, how much should I spend on groceries? I don't know. That's up to you to decide. How much should I spend on giving? I talk to God about it, but that's for you and your family to decide. How much should I spend on transportation? Well, with gas prices going higher, a little more than I used to. How much do I spend on clothing? You decide. When all is said and done, that difference right there ought to be zero. Okay? Figure out where it goes. It shouldn't be positive and it shouldn't be negative. If you've got extra money there, find a place to put it. Give it away. Put it in savings. Pay off extra debt with it. But choose where you're going to put it or it will be gone. Use cash. You'll spend less. You'll spend 12 to 18% less if you use cash. My wife and I went out to eat the other day at a pizza place. We both ordered a pop for the first time, and I can't remember how long, at an eat-out place. Each of our pops cost us $1.60. The reason that we don't do that anymore is we use cash. And for me to pay $3.20 for two pops is just ridiculous. A lot of times whenever we go out to eat, we'll split a meal. Proverbs 25:16 says, "Have you found honey? Eat only as much as you need, lest you be filled with it and vomit." When I go out to eat at some of these places that have big servings, and my wife has the big servings, and we order our separate, that's exactly the way I feel after I finish it all. I feel like I could vomit. Instead, why not share a meal? Cut down on your expenses. As far as budget busters go, you probably have some. I think some of the ones that trip me up the most are eating out. Control that. Medical bills. For some people, it's clothing. I have 100 pairs of shoes and I need all 100 pair. For some people, it's you've overbought a car. You're paying so much in a car payment that your budget just can't fit together. Sell the car. So yeah, as we try to break that cycle, we definitely have to identify those budget busters. If you've never done a budget before, give it 3 to 4 months before you even feel like you're making any progress and have any clue of what's going on. Because your first budget will not work. Your second budget will not work. And it'll take time to get all the numbers trying to figure it out. My form probably won't work for you. Okay? You can use it. You'll change it. You can use it, though. And the last couple things here is, when you're working on a budget, I strongly recommend that you work on it with your wife. And remember, there's two ideas here. One is that the bottom number needs to be zero. And the second is that we are commanded, 1 Peter 4:8-9, says, "And above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins." There have been times as I've been trying to build my budget that I do not agree with my wife. And sometimes I will adjust the budget and she'll get her way on it. Because it's just not worth it. I need to love my wife more than getting the budget like I want it. That bottom number is still zero. But out of love, I need to just say, "Hey, we'll do it your way. We'll try that." 2 Corinthians 9:8. This is one of those verses that I found as we were trying to put this workshop together. It says, "And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work." This is a sentence that I've got a friend that used to be an English teacher. You've got to look at the phrases. You always have all sufficiency in all things. That's just a statement. You have sufficiency. Here in America, we have sufficiency. The other statement that overrides it is God gives you grace that you can have an abundance. The grace is the abundance. And the reason He gives us an abundance is to do good works. When you get extra money, what do you do with that money? What's the abundance? What are you doing with that abundance? This verse says He gave it to you to do good works. So, in conclusion, I want to mention John 6:27. "Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life." Keep an eternal perspective on things. Okay? I'm a numbers guy. I get so caught up in building a budget and getting people out of debt that sometimes I lose focus of the giving. I lose focus of the eternal perspective of finances. I lose focus of the eternal perspective of stewardship, that it's all God's money anyway. I'm getting a part of it. It's all God's money. If He wants to take it all away, my hand needs to be open. He can just come in and out easily. So make sure that we keep an eternal perspective on it. Any questions that we can clear up or muddy for you? Yes?
Real quick, how do you get out of an upside down situation on a car?
On a car?
We got, it's a 389.
Sorry,
I don't care if they're buying this.
That's fine.
And we have a year left to pay on it until, well, we probably have around 8 months left to pay on it until we've paid down to what the NADA, value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'll point out, anytime you have a car loan, you're probably upside down. Okay. So it's not just your particular loan. Okay. Most people will say that if you can pay that off within a year to 18 months and you need that vehicle, get crazy about it, pay off everything that you can towards it, and pay it all the way off as quickly as possible.
Right.
Okay? So just because you're 10 months out away from paying it off, that doesn't necessarily mean sell it. Okay. If you can't, if this is your year number one and you're in a 7-year loan, you need to look at trying to finance the difference on that, is what most people will tell you to do. So you can go to a credit union or something like that, take out a loan. You're taking out another loan for to cover that $2,000 spread, pay off the loan, sell the car, and buy a nice old van that has 300,000 miles on it. So, yeah, that's what most people say. Any other suggestions or advice on that? There is a workshop evaluation form in your brochure there. You can sit around. I think all they're doing now is eating. So don't worry, you're not missing anything. And I believe you can either turn in those workshop evaluations here, or you can turn them in tonight at the service if you just leave it on the chair there. On the Friday, yeah, you can turn them all in. Okay. All right, thanks, guys.